Okay, let's get started a minute early. I'll make some announcements. So I have two questions already this morning about the homework six, which is the company. So you're in teams of three to discuss and argue and pick a company, but then each of you should write up your own one-page write-up in your own words after having all that collaborative discussion. I should have the homeworks. I had hoped to bring them back. They're all graded, but I couldn't get all the pages back from TAs who are up at the medical school. So I'll have those on Wednesday. I'll have another homework number eight on Wednesday, due the Wednesday after that. So far I've had one volunteer for presenting their company. So that'll be either the 5th or the 7th. And what else? Any other questions about sort of mechanical things? Yeah. Okay. So today I'm going to talk about, there'll be no profcast today, as I forgot to bring my laptop on. And today is the Horowitz Prize Day, where every year Columbia gives a prize to deserving biologists. And it's a very prestigious prize, and a large percentage of the people who receive the Horowitz Prize go on to get the Nobel Prize. So we think we have good taste in that. So there's a big dinner tonight. I have to wear a tuxedo. I'm so concerned about bringing in my tuxedo and have the shirt and everything that I forgot the laptop. So there'll be no profcast. Actually, who is listening? Anybody listening to these QuickTime profcasts? Seven? Okay, it's worth it. I mean, because it's not much work. So so today I'm going to talk about getting DNA into cells, moving genes around into cells, and various aspects of that, and then talk about gene amplification, because it's an important phenomenon that's taken advantage of by the biotechnology industry. And then next time we'll start with considering monoclonal antibodies, one of the main products of the biotech industry. Question?
Just to clarify, it's only MP3 today?
Only MP3. Okay. Yeah. And the PowerPoint, of course. So once Wigler, Silverstein, and Axel got that, made it possible for people to add DNA to cells and get genes in, and a lot of experiments became possible, really revolutionized animal cell culture genetics. So today we have a large number of ways to get DNA into cells, and so here I have this list. The original procedure was calcium phosphate co-precipitation. So calcium phosphate is not very soluble, and if you mix them at a high enough concentration, they'll form a precipitate, and if the DNA is in there with all those phosphate groups, it will precipitate along with the calcium phosphate. And these, I think I mentioned this already last time, and this, and these particles then will be endocytosed by the cells, and they'll make their way somehow through the cytoplasm, a certain fraction surviving, lysosomal engulfment and destruction, and get into the nucleus actually integrate into the genome often. The original experiments done with just total DNA from another source, high molecular weight, mammalian or vertebrate DNA, and today most transfers are done with plasmids. We'll talk about that. So lipofection here, which is in bold letters, is bold because that's the most common procedure. This is the formation of liposomes or liposomes, and these are multilamellar. So the lamella is like a coating. So it looks something like this schematically. The DNA is surrounded by this artificial membrane. And many different companies have their own formulation for what lipids go into that membrane, and each claims their product's better than the next. many cells, many of the common cells we use in culture are very transfectable in this way. There's always problem cells. Blood cells usually have trouble, or primary cultures have problems, or neurons have problems. But still can be done. So this is very simple. You just mix your reagents together, you wait a few minutes, and you change the medium, you dump it on the cells, and you wait. And the DNA gets in. Too much tends to be toxic, and then there's ratio of the DNA to liposomes is important. So there's ways to, instructions usually to optimize these parameters for your particular system. One disadvantage is it gets kind of expensive if you're doing a lot of experiments, because these companies charge a lot for these lipids. You can get just naked DNA without any other chemical added to it by a process called electroporation, in which you take your cells, usually in suspension, and add the DNA, soluble in suspension, in solution. And so the cells are surrounded by this fairly high concentration of DNA, and they're put in a small square tube called a cuvette. The cuvette has two electrodes in it, and you have a special power source which can control the capacitance and the voltage and the time, and you'll get a pulse of high voltage and a dissipation of that pulse, which has a certain kinetics, and those are the parameters that can be varied, and all those make a difference. And the result is you make a quick transient hole in the membrane, or holes in the membrane. And so everything in the medium tends to go into the cell, a little bit of it, including the DNA. And then the holes reseal. So all of this kind of hard on the cells, but with the right conditions, most of them survive, or half of them survive, and you can treat really quite high concentrations of cells, 10 million cells, quite easily in one little tube. Electroporation tends to give you a lower copy number, mainly because you're in control of the DNA. So if you put in a low concentration of DNA, you get lower overall delivery, but those that have received the DNA tend to have just one copy. And this was important, for example, in the Rice paper, where they needed only a single gene because their mutant phenotype would be masked if there were a wild-type gene along with their mutant. And so that's often important. So that's a good method if you want to bring in a single copy. On the other hand, with lipofection, for example, this DNA, which is just in letters here, has got lots of DNA in each liposome, so you're delivering a lot. There's the detergent treatment that can also make holes in membranes. Polybrene, I think I have a picture of it here. Yeah. So this is a positively charged hydrophobic compound, a CH2-6 and CH2-3 and a bunch of other CH3 groups, and a couple of these positively charged groups. They can react with the cell membrane. And generally don't get as high concentration with those. You can coat gold particles, tiny nanoparticles of gold, with DNA, and then put them in a gun and shoot them into the cells. This is often used for transfection that's taking place in an intact organism. Right? So you can shoot it into the ear of a rat or something. That's called ballistic. If you just counter-ion the negatively charged phosphates on DNA with a positively charged polymer, like a DEAE dextran, where DEAE is basically a quaternary amino group connected to a sugar polymer, that'll form a complex which the cell will take up. This is good for transient transfection, but it's kind of toxic for long-term experiments. Very recent, well, not so recently, maybe the last 5 years, polyethylene imide hasn't quite caught on, but it seems like it's a good method. Polyethylene imide looks like this. Each elbow here is a CH2, CH2, and then the NH2+, and that just repeats. So you have two methylene groups and an amino group. So the amino group is a very positively charged linear molecule. It also comes in a branched molecule, but the linear seems best for DNA. It forms a complex with DNA, and that's taken up by the cells. This is very cheap. That's one of its good things about it. And then there's other lipids which don't form a liposome membrane around the, like an envelope around the DNA. That's lamellar, but rather act as sort of more like individual units. So they have a charge group which interacts with the DNA, and then a long hydrophobic tail. And then through these hydrophobic tails, that's what can fuse with the cell membrane and get the DNA into the cell. So it's similar to liposomes, but yet different. And you can see they have names that boast of their effectiveness. Since a lot of what's taken up, especially by endocytosis, ends up in lysosomes, which are full of these degradatory enzymes, you can poison the lysosomes with a drug, chloroquine. Well, it's not usually done at all. We've never used it if it's just too toxic. But it sort of makes sense. And generally, these enhancements give you another factor of 2 or something like that. In the original experiment, some of the early experiments where they used total calf thymus DNA, that's a molecular weight of 100,000, say, and calcium phosphate, and then they went and looked inside the cell by in situ hybridization to see specifically how much calf DNA was into a mouse cell. Right? They had estimates that reached as high as 2 million base pairs integrated all in one spot. So you can get really a tremendous amount of DNA, and you wonder, you know, what kind of condition it is all in one spot like that. Today, most transfections are done with plasmids or viruses. So plasmids work okay up to about 10 kb, then they get kind of finicky. You can go into varieties of plasmids that hold up to several hundred kb, like bacterial artificial chromosomes, but most people work with plasmids 10 kb or less. If you co-transfect with two separate plasmids, then they tend to go into the same place. And the reason for this is not quite understood. You might not be so surprising if you had like a liposome and you had a mixture of all the DNA in one ball here in the middle. It's coated with this membrane, so it all gets in one fell swoop. And so they might all end up in one place in the chromosome. But even if you use electroporation, these are our own experiments, even if you use electroporation with just completely soluble DNA and you make holes, if you put in two different plasmids, 90% of the time they go into the same place. So there's been two explanations offered for this, and one is that when the DNA gets into the nucleus, it just gets ligated together and recombined and makes some big thing which then goes into the nucleus. This is the less interesting of the two possibilities. The other possibility is that the DNA is going into sites of DNA damage, and these might be semi-random, and they're looking for a weak spot to get in. Say it's being repaired by double-strand break repair, something like that, so that all the separate DNA molecules get funneled into the only place they can get into a damaged spot. In support of this, if you do a little bit of damage to your cells before you apply your DNA, that's been reported to increase the transfection frequency among the survivors. So there's some death that goes on. That's been shown for UV. It's not like there are specific hotspots for recombination. that accompanies transfection, which is semi-random. I mean, it's hard to prove it's completely random. But it, because if you do separate transfections, you transfect once, and then you transfect and let those transfectants grow up and select them, and then you transfect again, it will go into the second piece will go into a second piece of DNA will go into a completely different place. So if you want them in different places, you have to do a serial transfection. Most of this, by far, the great majority of this, in most cells, the great majority of this integration takes place semi-randomly. It doesn't take place at the sequence that's homologous to your input sequence. However, there is some homologous recombination that does go on at a low rate. Same experiment in yeast, most of it, and in E. coli, most of the recombination that takes place and integration into the genome after introduction of exogenous DNA is at the homologous place. But in higher organisms, it's generally this illegitimate recombination. And sometimes you would like, I mean, it's very handy to be able to go in and replace a gene or go into the same place where the natural gene is working to look at perturbations you might be making in that gene. So this is sometimes this is somewhat of a problem, which we'll talk about more in a few minutes. You can divide transfection experiments into two kinds, which is transient transfection and permanent transfection. Permanent transfection, sometimes called stable transfection. So in transient transfection, that's almost always done with clone genes, and the DNA is assumed to be mostly unintegrated. So it gets into the cytoplasm, it gets into the nucleus. Once it's in the nucleus, it gets expressed probably as a circular plasmid. What its state is with regard to its chromatin structure is not so clear. But the expression can be quite efficient. And it can be at high level because we use a lot of DNA, each cell would have many copies transiently. So you can study after 1, 2, or maybe 3 days later the results of the gene activity of the gene you put in. And thousands of experiments are done this way, and lots have been learned. Transcription factors, for example, can be co-transfected with your reporter gene to see if this transcription factor or that transcription factor, both overproduced at high levels in a transient transfection, help or repress the activity of that gene. Generally, the companies that sell your transfection reagents will show you pictures of GFP being produced by transient transfection, and they're often like 90%, the ones they publish anyway, 90% green. So most of the cells using these efficient reagents will take up and express the DNA in a transient transfection. Only a small percentage of those will go on to form stable transfectants. So so the criticism against the gene expression studies using transient transfection is that it's kind of an unnatural state for the gene. As I mentioned, that you don't know the chromatin structure, the methylation state. The cells may be under some stress because of all this activity that's going on. So nevertheless, you plunge ahead and draw your conclusions, and mostly they seem to be right. The choice then is whether you want to do permanent transfection. Here you get integration, okay, not in the right place, but at least it's in a chromosome. It's in a sort of a more natural state. However, now you have to worry about where in the chromosome it is. Is it over near the centromere where there's a lot of heterochromatin, which is chromatin that's mostly silenced? Is it in a happen to land right near a gene that's being expressed, like actin, that's being expressed at a high level, and that will influence the expression of your integrated copy? Certainly there is position effect depending on where it is. So you can run this kind of experiments and try to get around this position effect by isolating 100 transfectants, which you have to select for in this case because it's at a low frequency that such events happen. So you need some drug resistance marker usually, or an auxotrophy satisfier. That gives you then colonies which go up a week or two later, and then you can pool these colonies and measure the activity of your gene, your mutant gene, let's say, so that you're averaging out the position effects. More recently, you can buy cell lines that have integrated into them a site-specific recombination site. So this is a sequence, maybe 40 or 50 nucleotides, which serves as a coming from phage attachment site origins, where the phage recombinase will target such a site. So if your plasmid has the one form of the attachment site and the cell has integrated into it another form of the attachment site, then you'll be able to select cells that have gone into the right place. Now, what that right place is somewhat arbitrary. It's where the attachment site was put in the first place. But at least every experiment will give you the same position. So you don't have to worry about experiment-to-experiment variation if you look at integration into a site-specific site. In this case, you have to co-transfect with the bacterial or phage enzyme, the recombinase, that will target it. But that's not a problem. That's in the transient phase of that infection. You have your production of the recombinase from one plasmid, and you have your bullet that's going into the target inside the cell on another plasmid, and so it fosters the recombination into that specific site. Generally, you get about 1 in 1,000. You can get about 1 in 1,000 of the treated cells with enough DNA. The limit is how much DNA you can add. Too much DNA is toxic. Too long an exposure to DNA can be toxic to some cells. So a general rule, plus or minus a factor of 10 or 100, is about a 1 in 1,000 or 1 in 10,000 if you're looking for drug resistance. And then it takes a long time, depending on if you have a slow-growing cell line. Doubles every day, only once a day, you have to wait about 2 weeks before you can get enough colonies to analyze. Some of the earliest experiments, I mean the earliest experiments, but once Wiggler and the TK gene had been done from viruses, then the TK gene was done from total cellular DNA from chicken into mouse. And that was still really just getting the method down. So the first biological question that was asked using this technique was done both by Wiggler and by Bob Weinberg's lab at MIT. Wiggler was here at Columbia. And that was to see what makes a tumor cell. Are there oncogenes, positively acting, dominantly acting genes, which are responsible, at least in part, for converting a regulated cell into a dysregulated cell. So they took DNA from a tumor and they added it to these very regulated 3T3 cells that grow just flat and in a regulated way. And they both isolated the same oncogene, which was RAS oncogene. So that was like the first oncogene isolated, and it's part of a signaling pathway that indeed controls cell replication. So they could do this because they had a selection. And one difference between the normal cells and the neoplastically transformed cells, is these are rat fibroblasts, is that the transformed cells don't need to spread out and attach to plastic or glass substrate in order to grow, whereas most normal fibroblastic type cells need to do this. They can't grow without some kind of support. So if you suspend the cells in soft agar, right inside the agar, then they don't grow if they're normal, but if they're transformed, as in this case, this is that RAS transformation, they will grow into a three-dimensional ball of cells right inside the auger, and you can go in with a thin-tipped Pasteur pipette and pick them out and dislodge them and separate them with difficulty, and then plate them out on a normal dish so they can grow, and then see what you've got. The other kind of assay is the focus-forming assay, where cells will grow. You can't see it here, but there's a monolayer of very flat mouse 3T3 cells here on the left. This is graphic 3. And these are cells that were treated with DNA from this bladder carcinoma. In this case, I couldn't find a picture of that. So this is actually EGF receptor, epidermal growth factor receptor, which is also another oncogene. So you can see all these, this is now stained, so that you can see the otherwise transparent cells, and you can see these colonies, look like colonies, but actually they're growing on a lawn. So these are foci of colony of cells that can grow in a multi-layered way on top of this lawn. That's foci. How do they know what they had? They had human tumors onto mouse cells. So they could purify, they could pick one of these colonies, one of these foci, disrupt the cells, plate them out now normally so they can grow into colonies. And now you could pick one of those colonies and grow it up into millions of cells. And so you know it has some human gene in there, but how are you going to find that human gene? It was not that hard because the human gene could be screened for by hybridization. But how do they know what to hybridize to, right? Since they don't know what this gene was to begin with. We don't even know how many genes there were. They assume there were like 100,000 genes. But our DNA, like most mammalian DNA, I think probably most, I think plants also, yes, have a lot of repeated sequences in them, which are just riddled throughout the genome. And they're, I don't know if they're causing problems or they're helping, but and there are various types. Some are 2 kb long, some are 10 kb long, some are 300 bases long. And there's one in particular that's 300 bases long, and it's related even to DNA that's in E. coli. So you can sort of trace its origin all the way back. But they're different enough between human and mouse so that you could look for that repeat. So if you put in a big piece of DNA, chances are it's going to have one of these repeats, because this repeat is present in about 1 million copies in our DNA. It's called an ALU sequence, named for the restriction enzyme ALU1, for which it happens to have a site, maybe two sites. If you cleave mammalian DNA with ALU1 and then run it out on a gel, you see this very strong band just by ethidium bromide that corresponds to this couple hundred base pair ALU fragment. And the mouse doesn't have the ALU fragment, but it has a related repeat. I forget what it's called, MER, something like that. But it's distinguishable. So they made a library out of these, one of these clones, or several of them, of the whole genome, and then did plate hybridization with the ALU fragment to look at a mouse cell that was carrying the human ALU and had formed a focus. And from that, they were able to get that first oncogene. So that's a little bit of history. So transfection is with DNA is not the only way to get DNA into cells. You can use viruses. And two systems mainly, and there's several viruses, including herpes virus even used, which is a very large virus. Mostly they're small viruses, small DNA virus, adenovirus, or what's most popular is this lentivirus, which is a retrovirus, that is an RNA virus that infects the cell with an RNA genome, which then makes, with using reverse transcriptase, that's how reverse transcriptase was in fact discovered, was from such viral infections, makes a cDNA. The cDNA gets integrated into the genome and then makes RNA copies, which then leads to the infection. So it's going in and coming out again. That's the retro part. Very simple viruses. This is HIV, which is a retrovirus, and is one that is in fact used for gene delivery. So it's got a coding. Let's see, it's not the envelope because there's an env gene, which is the outer part of this coding, and this is the capsid gene, which is a glycosaminoglycan. I try to always give you definitions of these abbreviations, but I failed to do that here. And then it's got its polymerase, its reverse transcriptase in here too. And then the RNA is on the inside. This is has two RNA molecules for its genome. So if you can substitute your sequence for this RNA sequence, then it's possible to use this highly infectious capsid to bring in your DNA. And that's done as shown in graphic 5 here. First of all, you just clone all this stuff on a plasmid. And then you transfect this plasmid, just for using the standard techniques that I just described, into a very special cell called a packaging cell. Now, what's included in your retroviral vector, so when these particles are made, there's two things that needs to be done. The RNA has to be recognized by the viral machinery as viral RNA. You just want to package all messenger RNA in the cell. So it's got to have a packaging signal, which is part of its RNA sequence. And then it's got to have this capsid, which is looking for that signal to start to build a capsid around the RNA. So a cell then has been created that, I forget what the actual origin of the cell is, but the important thing is that the cell contains the GAG, end, and PAL proteins that the virus normally brings in. So these have now been put into the cell. And so the cell's just producing them all the time, and it doesn't do any harm to the cell because there's no packaging signal for the RNA, and the cell is fine. Now you bring in your retroviral vector, it gets transiently expressed, or it gets integrated, and then gets expressed from its integrated position. In either case, it makes now RNA that's got this phi plus packaging signal on it, and it's also got your gene of interest, gene X, and it's got a gene which is selectable, like resistance to the neomycin resistance gene, which we've talked about. So now, this RNA will get packaged by these capsids, which previously had nothing to do, and will contain your gene and the resistance gene. And now you can wait for a while. These viral particles, you notice the particles don't have the genes for the GAG, ENV, and PAL themselves, so they're completely non-infectious. They can get in, but they don't do anything into another cell. So they're safe to work with. So these bud out after a day or two. You take the supernatant medium off of these cells, and they're filled with these particles. You can purify them by centrifugation if you want, or if you want to concentrate them. And now you can use these to infect the cell you're interested in and look at the expression of your gene X in these cells. But the nice thing about this is the infection is virtually 100%. And the capsid proteins have been engineered now so that whereas there was often initially a great cell specificity, cell type specificity as to which would be a host for these capsids, now you have packaging systems that are so-called xenotropic that will infect practically every cell, including hamster cells and human cells. So it's more trouble. So most people just make plasmids and buy lipofectamine and put it in that way. Now, often you want to look for these rare cases where you're actually going into the normal position of the gene. Now, one very widespread use of such an ability to target the gene to its natural locus is to knock out the gene. So if you put in, if you could get homologous recombination to work, and you put in some DNA that corresponds to the gene that's your target, that's homologous to it, but is missing a piece, if it goes in and gets recombined homologously at the right position, it'll create a disruption. You could put, for instance, your drug resistance marker right into the middle of a homologous region. This is graphic 6. And if you get recombination like this for your gene X, now your gene X finds itself missing an exon because that you made sure it was not going to reconstitute a full gene after the recombination. The sequence that was there before that had the exon is gone because it's been replaced by this double recombination of this linear piece that's gone in, or it could be even a circle. And you can select for those cells that have received at least the plasmid that you put in there because they're resistant to G418, which is what's used instead of neomycin. And the trouble is that most of those neomycin-resistant, I'll just call it neomycin-resistant, neomycin-resistant colonies that result after your selection, that grow up, have integrated this in by illegitimate recombination somewhere else and have not targeted your gene. But a small percentage, maybe 1% or 0.1% among all the cells that did receive the drug resistance marker will be at the right place. And this will vary depending on the cell type. So something like many of the standard cell culture strains like L cells, CHO cells, HeLa cells, this is a very low percentage. Embryonic stem cells turn out to be, which are very useful cells to use because you can reconstitute a mouse from them. They do this homologous recombination at quite a bit higher rate. Still, you might have to screen hundreds, if not thousands. And how would you screen them? You could screen them by looking as to where it integrated by doing a southern blot. So that is a tremendous amount of work to do 500 southern blots, right? Or 500 lanes, even. You could do 50 lanes, that's still 100 southern blots with 50 lanes each. But people do it. This this graphic illustrates a trick used by Mario Capecchi, another Nobel Prize winner, who had the idea that since most of the non-homologous recombination, he thought, would take place near the ends, these invading ends of the piece that you're putting in. So if we would put a suicide gene near the end, we've already talked about the HSV-TK gene giving sensitivity to the drug ganciclovir. In this case, they used FIAU, which is works like ganciclovir. I forget exactly what it is. I couldn't find it here either. It's a thymidine analog, and the F is is fluoro. I remember that. So if the TK gene goes in, let's say, by, let's look at the bottom here, B, random integration, then the HSV-TK gene will tend to be intact. Should have drawn a little bit extra on the outside here. Actually, it's not my picture. And so the cells, in addition to getting neo resistance, which you can select for, have also obtained sensitivity to ganciclovir or FIAU. And so if you select on both drugs, you won't get any of these guys. On the other hand, in A, if it went in by homologous recombination, the homologous parts have been engineered to be inside of the TK gene. So as soon as you get homologous recombination, by definition, you'll be excluding the TK gene and you won't become sensitive to ganciclovir. On paper, this looks terrific. But in practice, it gives you an advantage, but it's not like, you know, 100-fold. It's like 5-fold. Still, instead of doing 100 huge southern blots, you only have to do 20. That makes life a lot easier. So once you've knocked out the gene there, you've only knocked out one, but you only selected for the drug resistance, and the other gene, it's diploid, is also there. But you're in ES cells, and you're going to make a mouse out of that ES cell. The mouse is going to be heterozygous. You just do brother-sister matings, and in the F2 generation, you're going to get homologous. You're going to get homozygous negatives, and you can study the effect of your gene knockout on the life of that mouse. If you want to study this in cultured cells, and you can't generate a mouse, then you don't have this sexual reproduction that gives you the segregation and the reassortment. So you're stuck with a heterozygote. And the only way to get the homozygote is just like to do it again and go through the whole screening again. So it's not done very often, but it's been done. And I'll just mention two studies, both from the 90s. In one, this John Sadaivi, who's at Brown, wants to study MYC, which is a cell cycle transcription factor, and the transcription factor is implicated in cancer a lot. Overproduction of MYC is one of the contributing factors for many cancers. So he wanted to know what MYC is really, what its normal job is. And so he did this double sequential knockout, screening lots by southern blots, finding the first knockout, then taking those cloned cells and hitting them again with the MYC disrupting homologous recombinant plasmid. And he got the double knockout. And those cells were viable. But sick. Sick in the sense that instead of doubling every day, they doubled every 3 days. But they doubled and doubled, and they grow. So you don't need MYC, actually, to grow, despite its famous or infamous job as this very key transcription factor necessary for cell replication. It's necessary for robust replication, but not absolutely necessary. Yeah?
Was it c-MYC or the n-MYC?
I believe it was c-MYC. Yeah.
Because c-MYC, it's as little as I know in the mosaic. I think the n-MYC is viable.
Well, maybe I'm wrong. It also depends. Later, he repeated it with other cells and got lethality. But in this, in his first cells, they were not. So you can go and check. I went back to the very first paper. Then in our own department, in a very beautiful experiment from Jim Manley's lab, he had discovered this alternative splicing factor. It was the first alternative splicing factor to be identified. And he wanted to know if it was necessary, what its biochemical role was, and if it's necessary as a general transcription factor for the life of the cell. In this case, they did a double knockout then, but they did it in a more complicated and sophisticated way. First of all, they switched from their usual HeLa cells or 293 cells to a chicken cell line, which he noticed had been reported to undergo a lot of homologous recombination. This is from the chick bursa, which is part of the chick's immune system, and the cells undergo a lot of recombination generating antibodies. So, and apparently this tendency for recombination of the antibody genes spills over into the genome in general. So it had been reported they undergo a lot of homologous recombination, at least a higher level than your normal cells. So they start out with these two ASF genes. So they put in a disrupting gene, which has got, first they put in, they figure if they do the double knockout and it's lethal, they'll never know whether the experiment just didn't work or whether it really is lethal. So they put in first an exogenous human ASF gene into these chicken cells, linked to the neo-resistance gene and driven by this TET promoter in the TET-off type of promoter. So their idea was they would first cover, in the absence of tetracycline, this human ASF would cover, hopefully, for the chicken, and the species difference wouldn't be important. That was a bet they made. And that then they could go ahead and knock out the two endogenous genes while they were covered by this human ASF. And then since the human ASF can be turned off with the TET promoter, then they could shut it off with tetracycline and look at the effects on growth. So they did that, and then they had these cells that were permanently carrying the human ASF gene, and then they put in the targeting homologous recombination disruptor, and they again put the drug resistance gene right into the middle of it. So this is the histidinol dehydrogenase gene, abbreviated HOL, and then they screened by southern blotting for the single insertion here. Let's see how that works. Histidinol is actually the penultimate intermediate in the pathway for those cells that can make histidine, which are like yeast cells. Not sure human cells can do this. So you have histidinol, which is just like histidine, except instead of the carboxyl group at the amino acid part of it, they have alcohol. So this, at high concentrations, this histidinol will react with the histidinyl tRNA synthetase activating enzyme, which takes ATP and adds AMP, makes an anhydride bond to this carboxyl, and then the same enzyme then takes the tRNA and sticks the histidine onto the tRNA, and the AMP goes off. So it's all a matter of getting enough energy into that bond so that the reactions go forward. So histidinol goes in instead of histidine, just sits there and can't get this AMP from ATP attached to it, and so it's a competitive inhibitor. So protein synthesis stops because you don't have any histidinyl tRNA, and all protein synthesis stops at the very next histidine. So it's not used that much, but it's a nice drug. Oh, so you have to put in just this enzyme, histidinol dehydrogenase, which then converts histidinol, this is probably from E. coli or yeast, converts histidinol to histidine, and then they're fine. So it gets rid of the histidine. So after confirming by southern blotting they had one, disruption. They went ahead and used puromycin, which is an inhibitor of protein synthesis. That's more general. And then screened again, and they found with a lot of work, they got the double knockout. And now they could add tetracycline, shut off ASF, and in fact the cells would not grow in the presence of tetracycline if you added enough, because ASF is necessary for life. And then they could put in different ASF, human ASF genes, to see what parts of it were important. And I don't know if they ever pinned down what was the weak link. Maybe it was just a general thing. Okay, so that's the... That's all I want to say about DNA transfer. And now we'll take up our last topic of the genetic manipulation of mammalian cells, which is the phenomenon of gene amplification. So there's several systems where you can get gene amplification, and you can study it with different things, different objectives. For the biotech industry, it's important because it enables you to put a gene in for a protein that you want to make and get many copies of it in that mammalian cell factory that you're going to use to produce your recombinant protein, whether it's TPA from the Rice paper or whether it's today monoclonal antibodies mostly. So one way of getting the most bang for your buck in terms of a cell that's producing as much protein as possible is to simply amplify the gene. So that's why we're talking about it in detail. And by far the most common system for using, exploiting gene amplification is the dihydrofolate reductase system. So, first of all, in the simpler diagram, a more complicated one coming up, this is the role of DHFR, which we alluded to earlier. The natural source of in our diet of tetrahydrofolate, which is the active form of this cofactor, is in fact tetrahydrofolate, which we eat in green vegetables. But if you take a vitamin pill or if you're making medium for cells, tetrahydrofolate is very unstable. So you give folic acid, which is just different because it needs four hydrogens to reduce it to tetrahydrofolate. And that's the function of dihydrofolate reductase. In the cell, since we eat tetrahydrofolate, in the course of doing its job, it gets converted back to dihydrofolate. And the dihydrofolate then has to get reconverted to tetrahydrofolate so it'll be active again. So tetrahydrofolate is a good substrate. It's very, very tight binding for tetrahydrofolate, very low KM. And that's why the enzyme is called DHFR instead of just folate reductase. But it will work also on folate with less effectiveness. And folate is what we supply in the medium. The tetrahydrofolate is necessary in several biosynthetic pathways, including methionine pathway, which isn't here because most cells need methionine anyway. That's in the medium. But it's necessary for glycine synthesis, for purine nucleotides, and for thymidylic acid. There is, in addition to the important part of the ability to use this system for gene amplification is the availability of a very tight binding and specific inhibitor of dihydrofolate reductase, methotrexate, or amithopterin. Those are synonyms. If you treat cells with methotrexate and you put them in a medium that doesn't contain, say, glycine, purines, and a source of thymidine, a source of TMP or AMP and GMP, like adenine or hypoxanthine, no thymidine, no glycine, then the cells will die in the presence of methotrexate. If you look for resistance to a certain level of methotrexate, you can get it by four different ways. One way is you exclude the method. There's some mutation on some not so well characterized permeases that I just changed this last night. So one and three kind of overlap. So it's a permeation problem. Either you knock out the ability to bring it in. So forget this last part. One is you can't bring methotrexate in, and so the cells become resistant. The other is that you mutate the amino acid sequence of the dihydrofolate reductase itself has become mutated in some mutants, and it doesn't bind methotrexate with such high affinity. So it becomes resistant to a certain level of methotrexate while still maintaining its ability to interact with and use as substrates dihydrofolate and folate. A third way, which is quite important actually, is increased levels of something called the P-glycoprotein, which is an efflux pump. It pumps certain molecules very actively out of the cytoplasm, out of the cell. And the substrate specificity for this pumping is a little weird. It's a lot of aromatic compounds that aren't so related to one another. And there's a lot of drugs, including methotrexate, adriamycin, actinomycin, that are pumped out by this. There's not just one, there's a small number of these efflux pumps. And as a result, the cell becomes resistant to a whole list of drugs that are pumped out, any particular P-glycoprotein that's increased in its level. So that phenotype is called a multiple drug resistance, or MDR. And so P-glycoprotein and MDR are sort of used interchangeably. And this is important because this is a major problem in cancer chemotherapy, that patients become resistant to the chemotherapy because they pump the variants among the tumor cells arise that I have increased levels of this P-glycoprotein and just pump the chemotherapeutic agent out of the cells, and they're resistant and they still form a tumor. Finally, among these, and the most common way, actually, that a cell becomes resistant to methotrexate is by overproducing the VHFR protein. So they just brute force their way past this methotrexate treatment. Now, the methotrexate that's used in such a selection has to be sort of on the edge, just enough to kill the cells. If you put in like 100 times that, then you won't be able to get this overproduction, as we'll see. Discovering what was going on went in a kind of very set logical, about every 2 years there was a paper that went deeper and deeper into what was going on as to why these cells were producing a high level of enzyme activity. First thing they saw was resistant to methotrexate. Secondly, they found that they have high enzyme activity. So that could be that the enzyme has become more active. Certain same number of enzyme molecules, but they become more active. So the next experiment, they used antibodies to show that it's actually not that, it's the protein goes up. So the amount of DHFR protein is actually increased, and then that could be for several reasons. Maybe the degradation rate was decreased, or the synthetic rate was increased. And they showed that the synthetic rate was actually increased by labeling experiments. Maybe the rate of translation of this messenger RNA per molecule of messenger RNA was higher. So there were experiments in which the mRNA from the resistant cells was translated in a cell-free system, and it was just as active as the wild-type cells. It was just that there was, it implied more of it. These all preceded having probes for clone probes. Finally, the clone probes came in, and it could measure directly the mRNA levels of DHFR mRNA, and those were elevated as well. And then finally, because, I didn't put this in, but because in parallel here, this is all biochemical kind of labs, there were cytogenetic labs that were noticing chromosomal abnormalities associated with this methotrexate resistance. In particular, they would see long regions of chromosomes developing with increased methotrexate resistance that were staining differently. There's a way of staining chromosomes based on GC content that will give you bands or regions of high GC and low GCs, and that makes it easier if you have two chromosomes, metaphase chromosomes, that you can see in the light microscope, that are about the same size and have their centromere at about the same place, and you want to distinguish them. If you use this banding technique, then they have a distinguishable set of bands. So you know one is chromosome 3 and the other is chromosome 4. Right? So instead of these bands, they had like a homogeneously staining region instead of bands. It was all like the same. So they suspected that something was going on at the DNA level. Many of these were driven by sort of a lac operon type of investigation. They thought, oh, this is regulation, and DHFR has been turned on because it's constitutive or something like this. But it wasn't that at all. It was that the gene was just more copies of the gene gave, and it tracked with the amount of RNA in the cell and the amount of protein in the cell. So these homogeneously staining regions is the usual manifestation of this gene amplification. I think I have a picture. No, I don't. Yes. So here's the sort of normal chromosome, which chromosome this is. Chromosome 2, I think, and this is in CHO cells. And this is a cell that has about 100 copies of the DHFR gene compared to this chromosome, which has only one, or maybe it's 50 copies. You can see right away, although it's only got 50 copies, there's a huge region that's been amplified. So, and just by measuring this and knowing the density of DNA along a chromosome, just by taking total chromosome length and the known amount of DNA in the cell, I was on this paper, we can conclude that the region that's been amplified is much bigger than just the VHFR gene, which turns out to be 25 kb. I mean, it's not a small gene, but the region that's amplified is more than 10 times higher than that. So here's this pathway in somewhat more detail, showing what's going on with the DHFR. And it's a little hard to look at, but I put it in there for you to, as they say, mostly not to hear now, but to gaze at, to understand the metabolism going on. So here's external folate coming in to form FH2, dihydrofolate. Dihydrofolate reductase acting on both parts to give this FH4, which is the active one, which then produces this key intermediate methylene tetrahydrofolate, which goes on, and in doing that, you get the production of glycine from serine. So the serine, this carbon is coming from the serine side chain. Glycine has no side chain. So that carbon is coming from serine, and then it's going in to help build the ring in purine biosynthesis to make RNA and DNA. It gets a triple bond put in for some of the steps. And it goes, so we've got the glycine, we've got the purines, and then the thymidine. So for thymidine, this is going to become the methyl group of thymidine, which distinguishes it from uracil by thymidylate synthetase. And you see, this is CH2, not CH3. So this has to be still reduced further. And the reducing power is coming from the FH4 itself. So these hydrogens become making this a methyl. So you get TMP. And then the FH4 gets oxidized to FH2. That's why you need the dihydrofolate reductase again to bring it back to FH4. For these other parts, it's just FH4 gets just regenerated each time. It's just a carrier. It's a carrier for one carbon units. But because of the thymidine step, it's got to be regenerated. And methotrexate then blocks both of these. This is what folic acid looks like, tetrahydrofolic acid with these red hydrogens added to it. Methotrexate, you can see, actually looks more like folic acid, which doesn't even bind that well, but it's got this methyl group, which makes the difference. Otherwise, it's pretty big cofactor. All these, it's got some glutamate. Sometimes these glutamic acid group here, and you could get 3 or 4 or 5 glutamic acids in a row. Somewhat variable, that helps keep the folic acid derivatives inside the cell. So a key finding that correlated this homogeneously staining region with the DHFR genes was to do it inside very early in situ hybridization using radioactive tritium-labeled cDNA from purified mRNA from an amplified cell line to produce these grains. So before fluorescent probes, this is the way it was done. This is in a photographic emulsion that's been developed. So that's the site of the DHFR gene, in fact, this homogeneously staining region. A more modern version of it looks like this, a lot prettier. And you see some background there, right? Fluorescent in situ hybridization using fluorescent probes. To get that kind of a picture, you need a lot of probe, maybe tens of kb. Another form of this whole business is starting to get rejuvenated as recent studies on chromosome disruptions and how it's related to genomic instability that is taking place during the genesis of tumors again. Here, the in situ hybridization is showing not a homogeneously staining region, but rather these, they call double minute, like little minute chromosomes, usually in doubles. So they call double minutes, DMs. And the strange thing is that at least one paper in the literature said they could find cells in the population, clone cells in the population from an amplified, this was actually a cancer cell, that had double minutes or it had a homogeneously staining region, but no single cell had both, as if these are two different forms of this amplified DNA. So you have like all these double minutes or one long homogeneously staining region. I should say, even though this has been known a long time, the exact mechanism for gene amplification is still unknown. I guess the best model is from this paper, which is from Barbara Trask's lab. And I don't have a picture, actually. But there were several methods. Over-replication was one, where you just kept starting the replication of the two daughter strands before starting it again and again and again, so as to make what they call the onion skin model. That doesn't seem to be what's going on. Rather, it seems to be associated with breaks. Perhaps breaks between joining of two chromatids, they're lined up. And if they cross over like this, then this piece will come out, and you'll have like a circle. And then at mitosis now, the two centromeres are going to pull apart, and these are joined, and so it'll break. If it breaks here, this guy gets no DHFR genes, this guy gets two DHFR genes. So it goes in this very slow, stepwise procedure. And you add enough methotrexate just about to kill the cells, you'll get 1 in 100,000 will grow up resistant, and will have a little bit more DHFR. And you take those cells and repeat it. So it's a very tedious process. Normal cells do not do this. Rather, P53, which is a surveillance protein, among other things, surveillance protein for genomic damage, the absence or defective P53 for those systems that's been looked at, which are at least two, is a prerequisite. If you have a P53 minus cell, it's undergoing gene amplification. If you put in a good P53 gene, it no longer will do so. You take it away, it will do it again. And from two different laboratories. Gene amplification, however, is not only a pathological situation. It's take place in nature when you need a lot of DNA, like when you want to make ribosomes in oocytes to support the growth of the new fertilized embryo. You make a lot of ribosomal RNA, so you get all these little circles known for a long time with ribosomal genes on them. So you get many more than a somatic cell has in this oocyte. Also the chorion genes, which forms the pellicle around the larva. You need a lot of it. They are amplified. But such states are few and far between. And I already mentioned the chemotherapy resistance is a big medical problem. Also, in cancer itself, you get overproduction of MYC, overproduction of RAS associated with tumors, and that's by gene amplification. That's not to say that RAS doesn't have altered amino acid structure, which also makes it aberrant, as what came out of that first oncogene definition. When they sequenced that RAS gene, finally, they saw that it was there's several single base mutations in it. It was also, interestingly, being spliced at a higher rate. But also extra copies. So the exploitation of this system for high-level recombinant protein production then works like this. If you have DHFR minus mutant cells, which exist in CHO cells, then it's a kind of an easy experiment. You can use the DHFR minus character itself, because if you're DHFR minus, you can't grow in a medium without glycine, a purine source like hypoxanthine, and thymidine, so-called GHT medium, minus GHT medium, that these cells will die. But if you bring in a DHFR minigene on your plasmid together with your favorite gene, then the transfectants will live. There's no methotrexate involved, right? So you know you've brought in your DHFR gene, and you've brought in your favorite gene. Right? Now you gradually increase the concentration of methotrexate and select for those few colonies that grow up that are resistant to this low level of methotrexate. And establish them so they're growing well at that level of methotrexate, and now you add usually several higher levels. And if you find some level that's killing again 99.999% of the cells, that is down to 10 to the minus fifth or less. And again, only a few grow up, and they have heritably resistant to this higher level of methotrexate, and along the way, you're isolating cells that have undergone this, for whatever reason, in these p53 minus cells, amplification of the gene, so they have more copies, more mRNA, more DHFR, more of your favorite gene, which gets co-amplified with it. This co-amplification with DHFR was shown even in those early Wiggler experiments and was part and parcel also of the original patents that Columbia profited by so much. So not only could you bring in your gene of interest using the new transfection procedure, but you could co-amplify two separate genes that got integrated into the same place. Remember, in those days, they weren't even using plasmids. See, I've got only 5 minutes left, so maybe I won't dwell on this complicated. So in a DHFR negative line, both copies of DHFR have been knocked out, and so these grayed out areas means you don't have any of this stuff, right? The way they were isolated, I guess I won't go into it. But it's kind of interesting. We isolated. DHFR is not the only amplifiable line. Gene. It seems as long as you have the criteria of a strong selection against cells that don't have the enzyme, any enzyme, and a tight binding, very specific, with few side effects, inhibitor of that enzyme, then you can get it in a p53 minus cell. So adenosine deaminase, for example. Adenosine at high concentration interferes with other metabolic pathways, but if you have a deaminase that sort of detoxifies adenosine, then you're okay. But if you put in too much of adenosine, you overload this adenosine deaminase, and so you would die. But if you amplify the adenosine deaminase gene, then you would live. And you can keep amplifying it by driving down the level of adenosine deaminase, where even if it's amplified by using this deoxycoformycin. So this is the analog of methotrexate. Right? So instead of DHFR and methotrexate, you have adenosine deaminase and deoxycoformycin. Right? Similarly, ornithine decarboxylase, difluoromethyl ornithine. Right? Thymidylase synthesis, FUDR. All of these have been successfully used as amplifying agents, but glutamine synthetase, the ones in purple here, are the ones that are used in the industry mostly. Glutamine synthetase actually is not being used as an amplifying agent. Many cells can't grow without glutamine, and in particular, these myeloma cells that don't produce any antibody anymore, and so they're the perfect cells to use, you would think, to make antibodies, they require glutamine. So if you bring in a mini gene for glutamine synthetase, then they will be able to grow in a glutamine-free medium. And if you add in addition methionine sulfoxamine, which inhibits glutamine synthetase, then the only thing that's going to grow are those that are making a lot of glutamine synthetase. And they do this, and you can get these producing a lot of your favorite gene because they're producing a lot of glutamine synthetase. But why they do is not so clear, because it's not by gene amplification, because these myeloma cells don't undergo the gene amplification. And pretty much what I said is there in graphic 21. Just running out of time, skip through this. And the remaining graphics just so show a couple of different strategies for optimizing the amplification. Since individual plasmids integrate at the same place, I told you, it's not even necessary, although most companies do it, it's not necessary to have the DHFR mini gene and your favorite gene on the same plasmid. You can just co-transfect, and they will both go in, and they will amplify together under the methotrexate selection. This enables you, for instance, to use a strategy where you use just a little bit of the DHFR mini gene and a much higher amount of your favorite gene, so that when they go in together, you're already starting out with a high ratio of your favorite gene compared to the DHFR gene, and then with more methotrexate selection, you can get even higher levels. Other tricks that have been used is to make a single vector, but then use a poor promoter or no promoter at all, for example. Make a dicistronic mRNA. Your favorite gene is getting transcribed and translated fine. But the DHFR gene, which is just a fellow traveler downstream of the stop signal, is only being read by read-through of ribosomes. And so it's being produced at a very low level. You don't need very much of this enzyme, because it's just vitamin metabolism that's used, needed only in very tiny amounts. So the lower amount of the DHFR you can get by with is in a sense an advantage, because if you have a very minimum amount of DHFR in your transfectant, then you have more room to add methotrexate. It'll be even more sensitive to methotrexate given its low amount. It could be only 2 or 3% of the normal level of DHFR will enable the cells to grow on this minus GHT medium. So you could use, for instance, promoter mutants. I don't know that this has been used. That weaken the DHFR gene as long as it can be expressed a little bit, and then you have more room for amplification. I know this is going kind of fast, but I really don't want to continue this for next time. And so finally, a protocol you might use is you first select on purine-free medium, graphic 29, and then you put it out on different amounts. Look how low those are, nanomolars amounts, and you find, well, you get just one colony here. You don't trust it, maybe, but at 10 nanomolar, you had some killing, but you have these survivors. So you could then grow these up, expand them under non-selective conditions, and then plate them out, say, again, under the same condition they were grown under, which you expect them to grow well, and then you find that you can go down four times as much and get the subpopulation in here that have amplified even as you're continuing to grow them. This is just happening spontaneously. That will have more. You take these and now you up the concentration. Each of these cycles could take 2, 3, 4 weeks until the cells you feel are growing healthy, and if you do it conservatively, so the whole process will maybe 6 months, and finally you have a cell that's making that has 100 genes instead of one. So we have a project in our lab trying to speed up this process. I don't know if it's working so well, but several people now working on that. It's funded by a biotech company. That's just a list of proteins. You can take a look at that at your leisure. But it's big business. This is sales in billions, $1 billion sales, or $6 billion sales for many of these. These are the monoclonal antibodies alone, which is most of the market now, because they're needed in high amounts, whereas something like TPA, not such high amounts. And these are some of the non-monoclonal antibody, blood cell stimulators, anti-inflammatory agents, interferons, insulin, growth hormone, TPA. Okay, so we'll start with monoclonal antibodies next time.